Okay, thank you, Mary. I hope you can hear me all right. So far, so good. Okay, thank you for this wonderful introduction and thank you for the invitation. It's great to have such a large audience here and to be able to speak on my research on the alt-right, or what has been recently called digital fascism, in this wonderful book by Holger Marx and Mike Fielitz. I gave a talk already this morning, so I'm a bit frazzled because there's so much work to be done. And this morning was kind of like I gave a talk to my funding institution, the VW Foundation, and we had to kind of like present our results, and it was very formal in a certain sense. So I will take the opportunity today to be a bit more loose about what I did in my research, and I hope that floats with you rather well. So let me first share my screen. It's 102 people. That's rather intimidating, but okay. All right. Can you see this all right? Yeah, so that works. Okay. I promised you in the abstract for this talk to talk about the current confusing and precarious moment that we are in 2021. And kind of like this is a very apt description, I think, for my feeling at the moment, because I just finished my book that Mary already introduced you to, which is called Rechte Gefühle. And this is the splash page of my publisher, Transkript Verlag. And so the book is now becoming real in a certain sense. And it's a very weird feeling for me to kind of like after 2 or 3 years of research to finally have a rather convoluted and rather copious volume of 480 pages to have that finished. And it's kind of weird when you just finish something to then speak about it in a coherent sense. So I'm still kind of like reeling from the experience. And I have to kind of like convey that feeling. I have a somewhat ominous foreword to my talk, which I will read, and the rest will be kind of like freestyle off the page so you can follow better. So this is my foreword. My book is finished and in layout. And instead of paraphrasing its key findings, I will take the opportunity today to speculate a bit on what is to come in terms of digital fascism, at least in somewhat in the second part of my talk. My book traces the online agitations of the so-called alternative right, or what is now called digital fascism, from the Gamergate moment of 2014, which probably most of you have heard of, to the election of Joe Biden in November. The people and the actors I studied that I found online and whose memes I interpreted and so forth now have made their way to the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and there they have entered the world stage and the center of global attention when they paraded their flags in the Capitol building. These are the people I studied in my book. They have made their way from online channels, from YouTube influencing, and from 4chan and Reddit threads to the Capitol building. My book about digital fascism, which focuses on their online agitation and specifically on what I call right-wing affects, and I will talk about that, for the past 4 to 6 years, that book is now becoming somewhat historical. And in a way, everybody and all of you and the global stage, the global public, in a way, knows what I know, because everybody now has seen in Washington, D.C., what I saw online in the past couple of years. And that everybody now sees this and it's out in the open is a good thing. In 2017, the internet alt-right folk, as they were then known, joined with real-world militias and white nationalists to organize the so-called Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and also then gave the alt-right its first appearance in the media spotlight. Now, in 2021, this particular movement has fused with that other movement, which believes in a stolen election that Donald Trump has won the election, and they believe in this alternate state formation, in this alternative America that Trump has talked into existence and kind of like executed into existence in the last 4 years. Whether Donald Trump will remain with that particular movement as their other president or as a media personality or even just as a meme is somewhat not the main question at the moment, I think. I call this movement a fascism from below that doesn't necessarily need authoritarian leaders like Donald Trump in order to be a movement. So the posthumes I saw on the subreddit Weekend Gunit, which you see in the lower left-hand corner, are now parading through the center of American democracy. And there, these people take selfies to see how they look in the place of, in the seat of Speaker Pelosi's seat in the Senate chamber. So kind of like the pictures they took before in their private bathrooms, parading their fantasy costumes and their weapons. Now kind of like they take the same picture in the heart of American democracy. The whole thing has a kind of like I was there or I am here movement. So these people just affirm their online presences in the real world spaces. So what is the usual or the casual or the everyday culture of 4chan or Reddit has now paraded through the mainstream press and the real world, as it were. And it's just the same in 2021 as it was in 2017, where they switched from being on 4chan to being on the streets of Charlottesville. And now they did the same thing in Washington, D.C. So in a way, everybody knows not only what I know, but everybody also knows what these people, these actors, these far-right actors, what they know and what they have to say. Everybody also, in a certain sense, knows what these actors feel, because we see their live worlds exposed when they parade. They came to the Capitol building with their fantasy costumes, with their employee badges around their necks, with their real names on it, and they came with their Southern Pride flags. They brought their whole live worlds, their whole ideas of who they are and their symbols and their names and their biographies to these public events or these public spaces. And they brought the live worlds that come from internet culture, that come from alternative media scapes, and that come, as it were, from a different timeline of American democracy or the United States of America and Germany, as we will see. So these far-right actors are doing what we could call an errand in time. They are kind of like erring through the wilderness in a certain sense. In a certain sense, they also appear quite ordinary. And in the way, they also are ordinary people. In my book, I was very interested in that particular moment, what I call the fascist ordinary. That is the everyday scenes on social media that these actors imagine, that they propagate and distribute. For example, when they take selfies in fantasy costumes, being a militia in their own bathrooms. Fascism in my book is an affective live world, a collection of sensibilities and of particular feelings. And namely, these are feelings of being at risk, of being betrayed, and of being marginalized as mostly whites and mostly men. Digital fascism is also, in my book, a collection of tools in order to distribute and disseminate these particular live worlds and these feelings, to make these feelings appealing to more people, to wider audiences, and to larger online networks. Digital fascism is, I would argue, a way to affirm one's presence in a media-saturated society, to become present not only in the Capitol building, which is what they did there, but also to become a presence in the digital. It is a way of performing in the digital. This practice of claiming a presence in the digital realm or in the real world will, in my opinion, remain whether Trump disappears or not, or whether the AfD will become a Verdachtsfall next week or not. So these media practices of fascism will remain, authoritarianism or populism notwithstanding. So why will that remain? And this is kind of like my question, why will these practices remain? And one of the keywords I have in my book is this is because of what I call a discursive climate change that these actors kind of like instigate and produce. It is a change of the discursive climate. It is the induction or the production of a certain atmosphere in which right-wing feelings and right-wing expressions and right-wing ideology become sensible, become reasonable acts of affirming oneself. So this is a bit ominous, and now I'll switch from the written text to freestyling. So to express that kind of like affirming a presence and then becoming part of a larger media practice collective, I found that expressed in a post that is at the end of my book, which is where the title of this talk comes from, A Creature with Life of Its Own. This is a post that was made on the subreddit on reddit.com, a subreddit called Friend World, which was a sort of crypto-fascist subreddit where people would have like simplified, like childish Pepe the Frogs with various, right-wing or neo-fascist connotations. And this is the quote, I will read it to you, by the user OpenS Video Editor. He posted that in 2019, or she, we don't really know. So the quote, "This world will only go more and more insane as the internet starts slowly sipping into reality and fusing with it. Each day I start seeing normies talking about things that were only discussed on 4chan. At this point, we created a creature with life of its own. This creature is restricted to colors of light emitting screen, that is a cell phone or a computer, but its effects on reality seem to be very real." And this is kind of like, there's a weird sense of pride in this particular quote, that an online realm has created a machine or a creature which will endure the work of its actors or the activity of its actors. It will run on its own. It's a Selbstläufer, so to speak. There's a sense of pride and also a sense of kind of like being being afraid of what you have created, you know, being cursed by your own creation, but also a strange sense of pride. Klaus Teweleit had a very interesting quote in his book Männerfantasien, where he called one of the key emotions of the fascist is a kind of like paradisic regardlessness, paradiesische Verantwortungslosigkeit. And this is something that fits quite well with this quote, I think. So I'm really interested in this thread that is in this quote, and that is normies, that is normal people like us, start talking about things that were previously only discussed on 4chan. And I feel I don't need to explain what 4chan is. It's an image board where fascism is kind of like the everyday culture in a certain sense. And so he talks about, or OpenS Video Editor talks about how this becomes real for more and more people and kind of like a live world that people share into. So one of the things that, for example, was previously mainly talked about on 4chan was the Great Replacement. And this is a thing that kind of like takes up a lot of space in my book. I will probably, some of you or most of you will know about this. I will just explain it in its meme form. The Great Replacement is a conspiracy theory or an ideology or a construct to perceive the world that teaches people to kind of like achieve an oblique status in the real world, where you can decode what is happening in the real world in a different way, namely in the way that how the everyday world operates, how media operate, is in line with a replacement of white people in majority white societies. So the imagination is that there is a greater plan to replace white populations with non-white populations in European countries, in North America, and so on and so forth. This is kind of like the centerpiece, the ideological centerpiece. You can find it in a 1990s book called Le Grand Remplacement by Raymond Queneau, and many other people in many other forms. Sometimes it's based on a secret Jewish government that kind of like instigates this plan of replacement. And sometimes it's because of, Western societies having gone soft or having become too multicultural or things like that. So there are different shades to this conspiracy theory. What these memes now that I present here that I've talked about in my book do is kind of like they interpret the Great Replacement in certain terms that people can identify with or that they can use in the everyday navigation of the world. One of the key words, for example, is that, or the key slogans that comes from the Great Replacement is a slogan that has emerged from the American neo-fascist scene, and it's called diversity is the code word for white genocide. And this is the other name of the Great Replacement, the white genocide theory. And this teaches people to read terms like diversity or Vielfalt or multiculturalism as secret code words that are supposed to cloak this larger project of replacing white populations and majority white societies. So you learn kind of like somehow you get a feeling that there's something off with the terminology that media use, that politicians use, that everyday people use in a certain sense. The other thing that one learns or is supposed to learn from alt-right agitation on the internet is what is on the upper right-hand side here, to learn to distinguish between the false media presentations of multiculturalism. And here you see various things like the Frankfurt School or, Hispanic sovereignty movements or other things. And you learn to contrast this with meanings that are attached to your race. That is, meanings that are attached to whiteness. You learn to identify whiteness, like white accomplishments, like walking on the moon, for example, or you learn to identify with Gary Cooper, and therefore you learn to have a positive sense to white identity. And this is the other thing that is less an ideological point, but an affective point. You are supposed to feel your attachment to Gary Cooper or to this weird Greek Roman statue or whatever that is. So kind of like it's a very phantasmatic idea of whiteness, that you are now peer to Beethoven more than you are peer to the Frankfurt School, for example. The Great Replacement then also circulates, of course, in kind of like this is the manifesto of the Christchurch shooter who killed 51 people in 2019, which already seems ages ago in a certain sense. With all the stuff that's happening in between. And he kind of like put out not only a theoretical or an ideological manifesto explaining the Great Replacement, but he also made the Great Replacement in a call to action that is something to be defended against with weapons, with massacres, and things like that. It also, and this is the lower right-hand corner here, the meme by Way of the World, the Twitter channel is called. That channel kind of like collects evidence for the Great Replacement in everyday culture. And here that person posts a billboard advertisement for a theater play called Shakespeare in Love, where the point is precisely to see that white men are being replaced by non-white male actors. And this is kind of like this is posted without particular explanation. So you already see it's less about making an ideological point for folkish identity or for white nationalism, but more it's about the induction of an atmosphere, like this is how the media wants to replace you visually. This is how the culture, the dominant culture, like a theater play of Shakespeare, erases white masculinity, for example. And so this is one of the points that I'm talking about in my book. It's more about, it's less about ideological orthodoxy for these alt writers. It's about creating atmospheres and ambiences in which kind of like you are less convinced or indoctrinated into white nationalism, but you feel an atmosphere of being endangered as a white person, as a male person, and so on and so forth. More memes in that regard are interesting in the way that they that they conjure the sense of being endangered through through an appropriation of Native American people and iconographies. So this is a 4chan meme on the left-hand side, where the viewer is asked to identify with a Native American who was also, and this is what the meme propagates, threatened by immigrants who were taking away his way of life. So the gist here is that white populations should feel as indigenous populations in Europe, for example, which are now invaded by foreign colonialists, which is kind of like non-white populations that migrate to white societies. And then these populations, these migrant populations, are likened to the colonial forces that invaded America and led to the widespread genocide of Native American peoples. So there's a kind of like affective dialogue happening between Native American populations and the white population in the current moment. So there's a kind of like trans-historical emotional connection that is conjured. And this leads to very, to memes like this one in the middle, or to real world actions. And this is from a British far right group who hung up a White Lives Matter banner in, I don't really know where it is, it's some cathedral somewhere, to celebrate Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. And of course, with indigenous, they mean white populations, white Britons, who are now being replaced or genocidally threatened from without and from within, as it were. So these are like less about making counter histories or making ideological points than I think are about creating an atmosphere and creating a self-perception as an indigenous population that is now under threat by foreign colonizers. The reason why I'm talking about atmosphere so much is because my book works with affect theory, and a very particular brand of affect theory you probably know as media studies students. You know about Brian Massumi and other people who talked about affect in media a lot. I work with a particular brand of affect theory that is inspired by Kathleen Stewart, who's an ethnographer and a queer studies person. And she's written a wonderful book called Ordinary Affects, where she kind of like tries to talk about affect in a way that is the scene of life, the scene of being in the world that is before you make rational choices, before you have concrete feelings like love or hate or happiness or something, that is feelings with meanings attached to them. But rather, she constructs affect as a kind of like sensory navigation of the world, where you kind of like you develop a plan, but the plan doesn't really work, and you feel like you nudge yourself into certain directions. And that book was very instructive to me because it's a very granular way of describing how people perceive things, how meaning is made, how identity is made, and how politics are made. And in that book, she has a very like key passage for me, also somewhat surprising because she talks about a lot of very different things and very mundane scenes. And she has a short entry about a novel called The Turner Diaries, which is one of the most important English language neo-fascist texts from the late 80s. The Turner Diaries is a novel which imagines a race war, where a group of militant white nationalists group together and commit together to a violent insurgency, and which climaxes in what they call the Day of the Rope, where all the enemies of the white race are hanged or killed or brought to justice in a certain sense. And she has a wonderful quote, a wonderful piece of writing about this book, which I will now read to you. The Turner Diaries is a recipe book for domestic competence. A little world comes into view. It is a world built based on a military model of community and skill, but it is one that is filled too with the textures and sensory details needed to imagine a dream world. This lived, affective constellation of practices and sensibilities make the book not just an ideological diatribe, which it certainly is, that is a neo-fascist treatise in a certain sense, but it is also a scene of life filled with worries, fetishes, compulsions, and hoped-for satisfactions. It is possible to imagine how, for those readers who find it compelling, but are not about to build bombs or throw up a race war, it is a kind of self-help book. It's a self-help racism book. And this is kind of like one of the key quotations in my book that I use from her to describe what social media practice of digital fascism is. It is, to a large extent, the fabrication of this lived affect constellation of practices and sensibilities. Like you've seen before in this meme with The Way of the World and Shakespeare in Love, this is about developing a sensibility, a kind of like different attitude to the things you see in everyday kind of like media or in your everyday life, to develop a different perception and to kind of like have a slanted position to them, and then develop from that a different scene of being in contact with the world, in which then right-wing ideologies make much more sense or become sensible in the first place. I will now give you two examples of how this works and how I have talked about my things. On the left-hand side here is a post in a men's rights forum called MGTOW, Men Going Their Own Way. It's one of the classic men's rights and misogyny kind of like filled forums where white men, mostly white men, talk about how they have freed themselves from feminism and from female dominance and things like that, and then reaffirm white masculinity. And there was this interesting post a year ago from a young man called Mr. Krabs, not Eugene is his username, and he posted this picture of his living room with the caption, "I'm moving into a new apartment after getting out of a toxic relationship with his girlfriend, and I'm finally decorating the place how I want to." And he decorates the place with a Donald Trump pillow. And this is kind of like one of these little scenes of everyday life in which right-wing agitation or like the affirmation of white masculinity becomes a way to improve your personal life against that toxic woman, that toxic feminist, that toxic feminist culture which devalues men, to free yourself from that. And social media are kind of like the realms where people express that and then can put that into the resonance channels that social media offers. So you get upvotes for that, you get likes for that. People chime in and say, well, this is so great that you improved your life, that you finally got rid of, you know, being dominated by a woman or things like that. And then this pillow becomes kind of like a thing that male empowerment works through, and that where kind of like anti-feminist feelings or misogynist feelings become a kind of self-help. The other example is from, I think, yesterday or the day before. And this is a guy, I caught him on Telegram, that was shared on some right-wing channels on Telegram, the messaging app. And this is a guy in Washington, D.C., and he's on his way to work. So this is a short clip I'm going to show you.
What's up, guys? New update. Friday, 06:30, Washington, D.C. And it ain't the police doing the checkpoints no more. It's full out military. Holy shit. I want to show y'all something. See this? See this military right here, all armed. I'm about to show you something very scary. These are big checkpoint gates. I'm going to show you something. This shit is fucking crazy. This isn't Metro PD. This isn't the Secret Service or the Park Police. These are Humvees with M60s and SAWs and M4s, and they're all loaded. And that don't look like riot control to me, but check this out. Look at these barricades with these personnel tunnels and shit to go through. I'll give y'all another update in a minute. I'm walking up to my job site now, so I got to check in. But the U.S. Look at this. This thing pops up so cars can't drive through it. This is what our intersections look like now. If you need all this to protect your inauguration from the people, maybe the fucking people didn't fucking elect you.
Okay, I always find it interesting when following these vlog type of formats that the right wing message that, for example, the election was stolen or that the people have been betrayed by politics or the elite or whatever is always just it's the final punchline in a self presentation that is basically about this is my everyday kind of like live world. And these two examples function like in a different way. On the left-hand side, you have kind of like the narration of somebody has put a rupture in his own everyday. He had a toxic relationship. He was living in an everyday situation that was unbearable. And the Donald Trump cushion enables him to express a rupture against that marginalization that he feels he has experienced. So he is able to disrupt affectively kind of like a system that he felt was stacked against him in a certain sense, expressed in the toxic girlfriend. The other guy on the right-hand side kind of like gives a sense of how the state disrupts his regular everyday going to the job, for example. So there's kind of like right-wing feelings enable people to construct like disruptions of their everyday and at the same time, affirmations of the everyday as a state of exception. Okay, these are just two examples of kind of like these granular representations of everyday experiences that these right wingers kind of like express all the time. And this leads to what I've called in the book, the atomization of risk positions or the atomization of feelings of alt-right feelings, basically. And you have just a couple of examples. Some of you might know some of these. For example, Lisa Eckhart and cancel culture, everybody knows about that. And this kind of like gives a sense to the sentence, the left is destroying Germany's freedom, which is like the headline that the AfD applied to that. And kind of like Lisa Eckhart becomes a granular or a very immediate experience how you can now see that your freedom is being taken away by leftists, you know, whoever that is. And then you have other examples. For example, this here on the left-hand side, white marginalization on Wikipedia. It tries to prove to the consumers of this meme that Wikipedia treats white people differently from other people. With the example that Black Pride, Asian Pride, and Gay Pride are featured with positive connotations, whereas white pride is featured with the connotation of racism and white nationalism. And this is kind of like proof in this meme that there is a shadow system in Wikipedia, which is taken as the mainstream culture, that is working in an anti-white way, which discriminates against white people. So you are being marginalized if you are a white person. I will not explain all of these. I've written about this on the lower right-hand corner here, which is Martin Zellner and Brittany Pettibone, his now wife, I think. And they have a series of YouTube vlogs where they do this kind of like darling couple thing. Both are white nationalists and they talk about, well, very different things and perform their relationship as a white nationalist couple at the same time. And this video was very interesting. That they talked about Tinder and dating apps and how people use them and thereby damaging the traditional heterosexual couple and kind of like destroy in a way white families in a certain sense through digital technology like dating apps like Tinder, OkCupid and other things. So they are talking about this as a couple that is threatened by digital culture and their way of life is threatened by digital culture. They also have in that video a note on the Great Replacement, how digital media works to further the Great Replacement because it damages heterosexual couples. But it's kind of like just a tiny thing within this performance of a couple within the digitized dating market, you know, how to do that. And it's very relatable and it's very cheesy in a certain sense, how they perform their coupleness. But this is kind of like things where vlogging formats and influencer formats tap very much into like everyday scenarios of living your life, of having your relationship and how the Great Replacement or leftist hegemony or something else interferes with that or disrupts that. Two more examples. One of the not yet banned YouTube channels called Blackpilled. It's a white nationalist called Devin Stack. He has a very interesting series of videos done that in which he tries to prove by close readings that classic Hollywood movies have marginalized white masculinity and have pathologized white masculinity. So he talks about that in a very cultural studies manner. So he analyzes films like, you know, cultural and media studies people do. But his point is always that, for example, the movie Falling Down pathologizes white masculinity. And it's very informative in a certain sense, and it's very granular in that you learn to have a slanted stance towards Hollywood productions and portrayals of white masculinity in there, for example. The other channel on the right-hand side is called Black Male, White Female Ads, which is a Telegram channel that is dedicated solely to collecting instances from media and advertising where a white woman is coupled with a non-white man. And this is kind of like, it's an endless stream of posts every day where whose basic point is just to produce an atmosphere that there is an erasure of white men going on in advertising, in movies, in Bridgerton, on Netflix, for example. And this is a very overwhelming amount of evidence for that phenomenon, which then kind of like just coagulates to a sort of atmosphere, like there's, it's everywhere, you know, this is kind of like the feeling that you're supposed to develop from there. These forms of agitation are so interesting because on the one hand, they of course revolve around, for example, Blackpilled revolves around the idea that Hollywood culture is not only leftist or multiculturalist dominated, but also Jewish dominated. So there's an indoctrination, an anti-white indoctrination going on in Hollywood movies. That is the right-wing theory. What he does at the same time is not talk about that, but he talks about how you as a white male person are being treated badly by Hollywood. So it's kind of like, and this is a switch that the alt-right makes all the time in their agitation, that they talk about kind of like the audience itself, about white masculinity, about white men. And behind that is the theory of a Jewish conspiracy, for example, or something like that. But you don't necessarily need to talk about that. The same with the Telegram channel. These are images which conjure something that the National Socialists called the Rassenschande. But it doesn't need to talk about that all the time, but rather you can be confused why there are so many black men and white women in advertising. And where are you as a white male in this advertising? So it's a very personal and at the same time, very, very ideological thing where the ideology is backgrounded in a certain sense. And kind of like, this is my favorite thing. He's a guy called Red Pill 101. He's one of the men's rights people on YouTube, also not banned as of yet. And kind of like what they do in this agitation, which is very, very everyday oriented and very kind of like self-help oriented, is kind of like they then enable you to make a connection between that question that he has, why are American men not getting laid? Why are they are not having sex? Why do I have no girlfriend? And they enable you to connect that to the theory of great replacement, for example. There is an erasure of white people, of white men going on through feminism, through multiculturalism, through Jewish elites, through whatever. And then you are able to experience that by your own, sexual misfortune, for example. You are not getting laid. It must be the Great Replacement or the Jews or a concerted effort by some shadow society or shadow system that wants to marginalize you. And it's not because you are creepy on YouTube, for example, right? So I feel I've talked about this enough. And now I would get to the more speculation part if I have time. And that is something I call mimetic agitation. So memes are a form of agitation, but also memes become a way of perceiving the world. You are becoming a meme in a certain sense, and I have some evidence for that. Now, everybody knows what a meme is, right? I hope. If not, I give some example. This is the classic meme formula. You have a template, and this is the so-called distracted boyfriend meme. And then that meme is reiterated in different versions, infinitely, so to speak, potentially infinitely, where different situations are applied to the constellation that is in this meme. So Phil Collins was a progressive rocker, and now he's being distracted by pop music, and he makes pop music, and progressive rock is sad about that or appalled by that. The same occurred on Reddit as a meta meme. Reddit was about daily Islamic terrorist killings and talking about that. And now after Christchurch, everybody is talking about a white guy mass murderer. And kind of like these are like political situations, or in this case, scenes of public attention that are modeled onto this template of the distracted boyfriend. The other thing in the lower right hand corners is rather funny, I think. So capitalism was had its firm grasp on the youth, and now the youth is flirting with socialism. I don't know if this is a critical meme or a funny meme or whatever. These memes are mostly open about that. The interesting thing I think about memes, and this has to do with a term that was very crucial in my book, it's called the attention economy. There's this theory from the 90s, or not a theory, it's a description of what is, I think. In the current age of media saturated societies, there is more knowledge than there is attention. So the hot good or the currency that internet societies or network society deal in is not so much gaining information, because there's always too much information, but gaining attention for certain things. So it's less about filtering information or producing more information, better information, but about gaining attention for one particular kind of information. And the skill or the competence or the practice that social media uses or the networked media spheres have to develop is to navigate very disparate information sources or archives, if you were. And this is what memes do, I think. Memes, basically, you navigate a visual archive of, for example, stock photography, which is what the original template was. This was stock photography. And you have that visual archive, and then you map kind of like real world things that you might perceive onto these things. And this is kind of like a combination, a navigation of very disparate knowledge formations or information kind of like archives. So you have a visual thing, you have a gender politics that is navigated in here, you have gender roles navigated, you have relationality that is navigated, and then you map onto that, as the person producing the meme, a certain constellation that is emerging. For example, here about attention, somebody is paying attention not to this, but to that. And so you have a kind of like meta meme on attention itself. So what memes do is actually they do not produce knowledge, but they navigate knowledge, and mostly to the extent that both that the knowledge is navigated in there kind of like collapse or are confronted or kind of like are mashed together in a sense that is not really producing a new type of knowledge, but rather what I would call a meltdown of the referential frame. And I will explain that in some right-wing memes that I've encountered. On the left-hand side it's kind of like it's an implosion of the referential frame in itself. This is a parody, in a certain sense, on the very genre of the cake diagram, of the, where different metrics are compared against each other. And the meme says that 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust are larger than 70 to 85 million others who died in World War II. This is not Holocaust denial, it's relativization of the Holocaust in a certain sense. And it's also a critique of memorial culture and of what Björn Höcke calls the der Schulddiskurs der Deutschen, for example. And this is a riff on that, and at the same time, it's a riff on cake diagrams. That cake diagrams do not reflect metrics, but cultural consensus about what memory is and what kind of like victim category counts more than other victim categories. So it's an implosion of the referential frame of the cake diagram of memory culture and other things, like in total, right? So it's a complete kind of like a counter reading, which produces not a clear counter information or counter ideology, but rather makes everything that is in this meme kind of like compromised and amorphous or free floating in a certain sense. So it's really about the point I'm making is it's about the disruption of knowledge by navigating various knowledges and various versions of reality, not to produce a new reality, but to produce what I would call a sticky moment, like an irritating moment where you don't trust cake diagrams anymore. You don't trust metrics anymore. You don't trust the memorial culture anymore. You don't trust the post-war consensus about history and the Holocaust anymore. And this is like what I would call an implosion of meaning that is performed by memes. On the right-hand side, you have a different thing, which is very popular, and that is when we compare the alt-right to Nazis, they have the countercharge where they compare, for example, third-wave feminism to Nazism, and then they have these checkboxes making them comparable. It's the same thing, you know. Feminism is just the same as Nazism. This is less about making the point that this is the case, but about imploding the frame of comparability. And this is what I would call what memes do. They produce sticky moments and moments of irritation where kind of like the reality that this information tries to conjure becomes floating and insecure and unstable. Now, this is something that memes do. And I think with the recent events, at least last year, this has become a real world tactic. And these are some images from around the Corona demonstrations in Berlin in August, where some, I don't know, a couple of thousand people, 40,000 people or something, demonstrated against Corona measures. And they came up with a weird iconography where they would liken the iron muzzle, that is a symbol of slavery and the torture device that was used in American slavery, and equated that with the Mund-Nasen-Schutz. And the thing I think it does is less that it that this person holding the sign here wants to express that he is now enslaved and that he's feeling like a slave, but he appropriates the symbol of slavery to talk about his own condition and thereby relativizes slavery and the symbol that he uses to a degree that is not recognizable anymore. The thing is that you claim, or that this person claims the symbol for himself, for his own feeling, being enslaved by Angela Merkel's Hygienepolitik and by Corona measures. And at the same time, he relativizes slavery and implodes the consensual meaning that Western societies have learned to think about slavery. So it's kind of like taking the symbol and hollowing it out and kind of like imploding its stability, making it unstable at the same time. And this is what I call mimetic agitation, which people do every day now, I think, in these Corona protests, for example, which is what they did in the Capitol building in DC, and so on and so forth. So I have only a few moments left. This is Attila Hildmann. It's more explanations of how people come to inhabit symbols that didn't belong to them in a certain sense and then destabilize them at the same time. I have a short quote from a guy. I will skip that now. This is basically a performance of a person who is talking to a journalist and accusing him of being a Lügenpresse, and he talks like a meme. Basically, he has a learned automated response how to talk to the press. And maybe I'll show it, just a snippet.
Schön, dass Sie auch hier sind.
Genau.
Was haben Sie denn Schönes? Warum sagen Sie Lügen?
Weil die Berichterstattung, die Sie über die AfD abhalten und über die gesamte Thematik äußerst tendenziös ist und mit dem öffentlich-rechtlichen Informationsauftrag absolut nichts zu tun hat. Sie sind ein politisch gleichgeschaltetes Globalisierungsmedium und nichts anderes. Und ich sehe überhaupt nicht ein, warum ich noch länger für Sie die Haushaltsabgabe, sprich die EZ-Gebühren, bezahlen soll. Sat.1 macht das Ganze mit 2/3 der Kosten, die ihr drauf habt. Ja, und die Berichterstattung ist auch nicht besser.
So this goes on for 5 or 6 minutes or something. The thing I find so interesting about like the way he performs, this is 2017, I believe, at some AfD demonstration that they did in Berlin. The script that he acts upon is a learned script. It's a rehearsed script. It's an automated script that he has performed and rehearsed and learned, basically. So he becomes a medium by himself that has now his big moment vis-a-vis a different medium, which is the mainstream medium. So he affirms himself as a meme or as a medium against that. And this is kind of like one of the empowerment scripts that the alt-right offers. You can become your own medium, which then takes a stance against the other media. And this is a very, very interesting performative and everyday script that these people work on, basically, to have these automated responses where they can destabilize the whole frame of reference, where they're being asked by the press about their opinion, and they counter by being the press themselves, in a certain sense. These are more things like that. And so that this is a version of the chat meme, which is really popular since last year. Where is the chat is an interesting figure. It's the bearded figure over here. He is supposed to be a white nationalist kind of guy with the beard and stuff. And the chat meme is an affirmative meme. So the chat is only the person is the person who answers yes to all the charges. So if somebody, like on the left-hand side here, the gray figure that is the so-called NPC, the non-player character. These are all the leftists and the brainwashed gender studies people and the liberals and so on, who would basically say, well, you're a Nazi, you're a racist. And the chat in the meme form always says, yes. This is the only kind of like wording that the chat has. He affirms everything, all the charges. So it's kind of like the perfect counter to all the charges, like you are a bad person, you are a racist, whatever. Yes. And this is kind of like the basic expression of an optimistic everyday formula that you can use, that the right wing offers, that the alt-right offers, to switch the frame of reference, to destabilize the frame of reference, which the public attributes to you. Okay, and with that, I come to kind of like a future. And that is the idea that I'm following at the moment, that the memes have in a way come alive. There's no longer a real valid distinction between real world like fascist militias or right-wing networks like the identitarian movement and the meme world, which is then ironic and media and whatever, but kind of like these worlds have not only collided but really fused, as in the quote I gave you earlier from Friend World. And I have a couple of examples. These are post-election memes coming from various right-wing forums, for example, Tucker Carlson, the forum, where people just do not believe that the meme war is over and they will refuse to accept anything like a political solution, because the meme as a media structure, the meme is a thing that cannot die. The meme just mutates and is reiterated and produces versions of itself. It can only die from overexposure. That is, the meme becomes too popular and then it dies in a certain sense. And so this is kind of like the stance that I feel that a lot of the people that I'm researching and that I followed are in, like, this cannot be over. It's a self-running system. It's a Selbstläufer. And so it will never be over. And this is quite close to the classic neo-fascist stance, there is no political solution, there are only violent solutions. And this is quite close to that. So they're actually like the memesters and the trolls are kind of like getting into the mindset of white nationalists and neo-fascists. They also assemble under these weird mimetic forms of envisioning a political climate or a state formation, which is this weird crossover from Berlin in August from the Hygiene demo, where QAnon, Trump, and the Kaiserreich are kind of like fused together to create this kind of like fantastical alternate formation of a state or a government or a world that you want to live in. And these fantasy worlds, I think, are becoming, with the memes together, becoming more real for more people. One of the weird things that I haven't talked about in the book, this is from the Junge Union Chemnitz, like the youth division of the CDU, kind of like makes the same affective point that right-wing agitation does in order to distance themselves from the Linkspartei and things like that. This is how young people are supposed to feel and not to feel. Like, am I an evil person because I'm white? No, the Junge Union has got you. You're not an evil person, you know? And this is kind of like what I would call the mainstreaming of these affective politics. So to conclude, this is Arnold Schwarzenegger, who released a very nice video after the Capitol attack or Capitol storming, which I teased on Twitter. And I will just show you the video if you haven't seen it. It's gorgeous.
I've told everyone who has called that as heartbreaking as all of this is, America will come back from these dark days and shine our lights once again. Now you see this sword? This is the Conan sword. Now here's the thing about swords. The more you temper a sword, the stronger it becomes. The more you pound it with a hammer and then heat it in the fire, and then thrust it into the cold water, and then pound it again, and plunge it into the fire and into the water. The more often you do that, the stronger it becomes. I'm not telling you all this because I wanted to become an expert sword maker, but our democracy is like the steel of this sword. The more it is tempered, the stronger it becomes. Our democracy has been tempered by wars, injustices, and insurrections. I believe, as shaken as we are by the events of recent days, we will come out stronger because we now understand what can be lost. We need reforms of...
Yeah, and then comes some yada yada about Biden and whatever. This was such an interesting contribution and such an interesting meme for various reasons. The American public, at least what I saw on Twitter, kind of like thought this was a good intervention because there was somebody from the Republican Party who came out to say like the storming of the Capitol was an attack on democracy. And kind of like this was, and then he made some connections to his biography as an immigrant to post-war Austria, post-fascist Austria, and things like that to send a message of unity. So people kind of like that. German audiences, I found, were very troubled because he likened the storming of Capitol to the Reichskristallnacht, which is, of course, a very weird connection to make and a very wrong connection to make. And also because the video is blatantly American exceptionalism. So this is about the great shining nation, which will rise again from the ashes to become even more exceptional and things like that. I found this very interesting in terms of the memes that this plays with, because Schwarzenegger very consciously produces the Conan sword because he played Conan the Barbarian in the 70s movie, because he's aware of the meme quality that this particular gesture has. Conan the Barbarian has been for a long time one of the meme staples of the alt-right and also 4chan and the wider internet sphere. With the line, what is the best thing in life? And this is a line from the Conan movie. The best thing in life is to crush your enemies, to see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentations of their women. This has been used by the alt-right over and over again to crush all the cucks, as you see here on the right-hand side, and to hear the lamentations of SJW. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think, is aware of this mimetic quality of the sword and of the Conan figure, Which of course stands for white dominant Western European masculinity. And he kind of like tries to reclaim that and take this kind of like meme away from them in a certain sense. He also comes back to the deplorables meme, which kind of like won Donald Trump's election. If you don't know that, you can ask about it later in the discussion. Because the deplorables went back to an action movie called The Expendables, in which Schwarzenegger was in the second part, which was about elderly white muscle men of the 1980s coming back as an action team. So it was this big lineup of former 80s and 90s muscle stars like Dolph Lundgren and other people. And kind of like Schwarzenegger does this video very consciously because he knows about the significance that he or Sylvester Stallone or all these 80s Reaganite white muscle masculinities have for the alt-right. And so he comes back to declaim that. What I also find interesting, and this is kind of like the thing where it's super speculative and super like what I feel basically about this meme, is that he likens democracy to a sword. And this goes back to a misrepresentation that Franz Kafka had in his novel America, where the Statue of Liberty doesn't carry a torch but a sword. This is kind of like because Kafka never was in America, but it's also kind of like an apt metaphor, I think. Because one of the things that I have a problem with and that I write about in my book is that the usual response of liberal societies of Germany and of America to this new fascism is that democracy has to become wehrhaft. This is one of the things that is written in this book, for example, and all the other people who write on right-wing populism and on new fascism and things like that always say fascism is an attack on democracy and democracy has to become fortified, which is kind of like what Arnold Schwarzenegger expresses. Democracy is a sword. Right, it needs to defend itself with a sword. And this, of course, again, reiterates a right-wing iconography that is very old, Donald Trump as the crusader, the alt-right as the crusaders of the modern age against the Islamization of the Western world, and the whole thing of, you know, the godly mission with sword in hand to kill the infidels. And so kind of like this is a very weird thing that is going on in there, which I'm very ambivalent about, basically because I'm very skeptical of this idea of a fortified democracy and what that is supposed to mean. And this is something that maybe I would like to express about it. The idea of a fortified democracy or wehrhafte Demokratie always says like we need to have harte Diskursgrenzen, hard borders where we don't talk to fascists, for example, hard like censorship and things like that. And the basic thing, the basic misconception, I think, is that fascism, in a certain sense, even though it storms the Capitol, it is not an attack on democracy. It is an attack on particular people. It's a particular attack on people who are framed in the Great Replacement as invaders and as people who are destroying Western culture or democracy in a certain sense. And kind of like this whole sword thing kind of like reverberates for me in there that I would say the response would not be to have democracy have a barbarian sword, but rather for democracy to protect the people who are really attacked by fascists. And those are mostly marginalized people, non-white people, non-heterosexual people, and so on and so forth. And this is kind of like one of the things that I wonder about this sword metaphor, which I really would like to discuss with you about. And yeah, on the other hand, I think also if memes only die from overexposure, then maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger doing this whole thing is a good way of, you know, killing that meme that is fascism at the moment. So, and with that, I thank you and look forward to the discussion.